Good morning. While we wait for all of our virtual participants to show up today, just want to give a brief introduction. Thanks for joining us today. Today, we're going to be talking about public-private partnerships and innovation. This comes from two chapters that are in the recently published book, 10 Years In, Implementing Strategic Approaches to Cyberspace. The first is written by Erica Borgard and Sean Lonergan and deals specifically with public-private partnerships and cyberspace strategy. And then the second chapter is written also by one of our guests, Dr. Peter Dombrowski, and his co-author, Dr. Nina Collars. And they look specifically at innovation. So what is the technological base? How do we think about cybersecurity and technology for the Department of Defense? Today, we're going to be talking about these kind of bins of public-private partnership more generally, and I'm lucky to have an extraordinary group here with me. Not only do I have the authors from 10 Years In, Dr. Erica Borgard, who is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Dr. Peter Dombrowski, who's a professor of strategy at the Naval War College and the Ruger Chair of National Security and Economics. But I also have with me two of my colleagues here at Hoover who are just extraordinary thinkers, and it's amazing I was able to get in their schedules. Dr. Amy Ziegert, who is the Morris Arnold and Nona Jean Cox Senior Fellow at Hoover, as well as a Senior Fellow at FSI, all here at Stanford. And then Dr. Joe Felter, who is a research fellow at Hoover and the William Perry Fellow at CSAC. So I'm really honored to have with us this extraordinary group of people. Today we're going to be talking about public-private partnerships and what that means for information sharing, what that means for technology. But I want to be really honest, because public-private partnerships is one of these words that we hear all the time and is used so broadly and so often that actually has very little meaning. I mean, I tell people that if I was going to have a bingo card of buzzwords that you would hear at like a cyber conference, I would put public-private partnerships right in the middle. So I want to use this opportunity to get a little bit more integrity on what this actually means. So I want to ask, I'll start with Amy. What is public-private partnerships? What does that concept mean to you? And then your work specifically has looked very closely at intelligence and information sharing. So interested in kind of what you see as public-private partnerships in the work that you do.
Well, first, let me just say, Jackie, what an honor it is to be here. I have loved tuning into your Friday morning chats on cyber with all the different people you brought in. And congratulations on this terrific book, which I read with great interest. So thanks for enabling me to be a part of it. Thanks also for the softball first question, Jackie. What is a public-private partnership? So I think there are two parts to that question, right? What is it for and who is it with, right? So what are public-private partnerships for? There's a lot of focus, as you say, on information sharing. So we know that the government is really capable at understanding some cyber threats, but private industry also has real situational awareness of nefarious activities on their network. So how can we share information, anticipatory information, as Erica points out in her great chapter, to better enable protection of our networks across the public and the private sector, particularly given that critical infrastructure, as you all know really well, 85% of it is owned and operated by the private sector. So information sharing is a part of what the goal is of public-private partnerships, but it's not the only goal of public-private partnerships, right? So in an area that I know Joe knows well, public-private partnerships are also about talent, right? How can we get people going between the public and the private sector? So that's a key part of it too. And then sort of the resilience, right? How can we have playbooks and capabilities for responding both across the public and the private divide? So that's the what's it for. Who's it with, though, I think is really more problematic than we think. So even the term public-private partnership leaves out one critical set of actors, academics, right? So there are three legs of this stool. It's the public sector, the private sector, and the academy when we think about critical technologies that need to be protected. And yet academics are almost never discussed when we talk about public-private partnerships and how we shore up systems and technologies. So I want to put that out there for us to chew on a little bit more.
So I want to take away Amy's comments and then pivot to you, Erica, because Erica, your chapter is specifically about public-private partnerships in cyberspace, and you talk very concretely about initiatives that the Department of Defense has been working on. And also, I want to highlight to people, Erica has two kind of really important kind of life experiences here. One is that she actually served in a very special kind of fellowship through the Council on Foreign Relations, where she was able to work literally with the financial sector and cyber command, so like combining the two. And then she also led one of the task forces on the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. So she's thought about this in terms of the Solarium Commission and legislation and kind of what that means. So Erica, I'd love to hear kind of from your perspective, what are these public-private partnerships when it comes to the DoD? And also, I would love to hear your thoughts about how they might be different, more opportunities or more challenges than perhaps the intelligence community.
Yeah, thanks, Jackie. And thanks for having me here with this esteemed group of colleagues. You know, just on your point about the CFR International Affairs Fellowship, to me, that was really such an incredible opportunity that helped me crystallize my thinking about this particular issue. And so for that year, I spent the first 6 months working at JP Morgan, and then the second 6 months at Cyber Command. And I worked on the same problem set from two very different perspectives. So this was around the time that Cyber Command was piloting what's now one of the Pathfinder efforts with collaborating across interagency and with the financial services sector and also with the energy sector. Initially, it was called Project Indigo. And it was basically the government and financial services, really only a few of the largest entities within the financial services, trying to figure out how to collaborate, how to even set up a sort of ad hoc pilot type of program to share information and do some joint training and figure out how to work together. And you know, there's a lot of debate about how successful the program itself was, but I think the success was simply in the proof of concept that this thing could exist, which I think was probably sort of beyond what most observers would have seen is within the realm of the possible even a few years prior. So that's kind of a long-winded personal narrative. But Jackie, to your question about the DoD and the defense industrial base in particular, you know, in the book chapter that me and my co-author wrote about, we kind of, you know, public-private partnership or public-private collaboration, to Amy's point, really, in many ways, is a function of who participates. And you would think that sort of the easiest sort of public-private collaboration would be between the Department of Defense and the Defense Industrial Base, right? So the DoD is the sector-specific agency for the DIB. You already have an environment where you have personnel in the private sector who have a lot of professional experience working in the Department of Defense. They already operate in a classified environment. We talk about sort of overclassification as a problem. That challenge is far more ameliorated here. And yet you don't have the sort of as sort of robust and complete structures and organizations and processes to enable meaningful operational collaboration across sort of the full cycle of cooperation on information sharing and intelligence, on doing sort of joint planning and preparation, developing joint CONOPs, and then actually being prepared to sort of respond when, if and when events occur. And so what we outlined in the book chapter, and also a lot of the work that was done in Task Force One and the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, was to think about, you know, how can we take some of the existing information sharing programs and make them more robust. And so create a mandatory threat intelligence sharing program between the DIB and the DoD. Those programs exist. They exist across different entities. It's not clear who the primary sort of stakeholder is within the DoD, and they're not required. There are certain forms of information sharing that are required, but participating in that program is not a requirement. The other important thing that we worked on, and we also we talk about in the book chapter, and also worked on the Solarium Commission, was having this sort of mandatory threat hunting program across the DIB to be able to have a more complete picture of the threat environment, and also to be able to rapidly sort of remediate and address threats if and when they occur. And so I just think it's interesting to focus on that relationship, because you would think it would be the easiest use case. But in fact, there's still lots of challenges, which suggests that across other critical infrastructure sectors, the challenges are even greater and more significant.
So that's a really great way to pivot over to Peter, because what Eric is talking about, the defense innovation base, is a conglomerate, well, conglomerate is maybe the wrong word, it's not completely organized, but it's a group of organizations, a group of companies that primarily their job is to provide weapon systems, information, consulting to the Department of Defense. So the defense industrial base would include companies like Lockheed, Boeing, Booz Allen Hamilton. And, you know, their primary consumer and customer is the government and the Department of Defense. Now, Peter has been looking at how the defense industrial base builds technology in response to government and DoD needs for a long time. I mean, going back a few decades here. But in this chapter, he looks specifically at kind of how is the defense industrial base different when it comes to cybersecurity and technology, and how much does the DIB and the cybersecurity ecosystem actually overlap? So I'd love to hear your thoughts about kind of what that looks like from your perspective.
So Jackie, I'm going to be a little bit of a contrarian, which if anybody who knows me is pretty much my standard shtick. And the first thing I'm going to say is I'm a little bit skeptical about how well public-private partnerships do on sort of core issues. I think there's definitely a room for the public and the private to work together. But even as Erica mentioned, and I think Amy mentioned too, at some point it comes down not to just partnerships and sort of sharing, but it's almost a command and control and a regulatory relationship by mandating sort of exchange of information rather than simply voluntarily giving it up. The other thing that's kind of contrarian is I'm very influenced because I'm just about finished with Nicole Perlroth's new book. What's the title of it? The title is This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, which is essentially about hacking the hacker communities and its intersection with the industrial the industrial base more generally. And the takeaway I have from that book, which fits in with some of the things I've thought for a long time, is that in some ways there remains an adversarial relationship between the government and the private sector, particularly on things like innovation, how to pay for it, what kind of innovations we need, how deeply the government should be involved in shaping the nature of innovation, what kind of incentives are there for corporations to do the kind of things the government, the military, the intelligence community think they need. So I don't know if I answered your question directly, but you know, just to summarize, I think public-private partnerships only take us so far. I think that there remains, if not adversarial, certainly contentious relations between the defense industrial base and the government. I think this is particularly true in the cyberspace, broadly defined, and that the communication between the two sides isn't as good as you think, given the tangled interrelationship of many of the engineers and the officials, the acquisition officials and so forth, who have this sort of in and out relationship. And I can talk more to that later, but you know, I'm the skeptic, and that doesn't mean I'm giving up hope, but I'm skeptical about some of this. Thank you.
Well, I would say I'm more skeptical. I'm more optimistic about our ability to share information and more pessimistic about our ability to collaborate in a useful way to actually develop technology. And on that, I want to pivot over to Joe, because Joe has done a remarkable job sitting here in Silicon Valley of trying to build these networks of relationships and to build kind of competencies about sharing information and innovating between the Department of Defense and the Silicon Valley that we live in. But Joe has built a program and pioneers a program where he works also with undergraduates in this concept called Hacking for Defense. And Joe, I was interested in if you could kind of explain to everyone, because this is one of Amy's three legs, you know, the academia leg, what is the Hacking for Defense? And then, you know, how can that be useful for the DoD when they're thinking about innovating in cyber?
Great. Well, thanks for the chance to join, Jackie. And just echoing Amy and others' comments on just what a fantastic program you set up, and we're honored to be here with this great panel. But yeah, so what is Hacking for Defense? It's a program we piloted here at Stanford back in 2016. Actually, I was at CSAC when Amy was the co-director at the time. And it was kind of motivated by this thought that, you know, young people, this notion they don't want to serve, they don't want to get involved, they don't want to contribute to defense and government challenges. It's a real misnomer. But we thought if we could give them this opportunity to contribute, you know, if you build the field, maybe they would come. So Hacking for Defense was inspired by Steve Blank, who's an entrepreneur and co-developer of the course here. His class that used basically the lean methods, this approach to building startups. And his classes were wildly popular because students would come together and build startups. And, you know, it's the Stanford way, right? You go, you create a startup, you sell it, and you're done before you're 30. But we thought we'd take Steve and I and another colleague, Pete Newell, a retired Army colonel, got together and let's take this lean approach to building companies and see if we can apply it to addressing DoD challenges, government challenges. So we put a lot of time into developing this program. And it was challenging because in the startup world, you measure success by profit, right? But when you're supporting the government and government challenges or the DoD challenges, it's success is measured at impact, mission accomplishment. So we kind of had to tweak the methodology a bit. But so we built this program, and then we decided, oh my gosh, is anyone going to take this class? And we were thinking, what are the incentives to take an entrepreneurship class where you can build a startup are clear for students. But boy, what are the incentives to work for the government to help the DoD solve a tough challenge? Fortunately, the class is oversubscribed and you know, 3x students applied than we had space for. So that was a relief. But it was really wonderful to see that the students, when given the opportunity to work on a really challenging problem for the government, and some of these were a lot more cyber related, you know, and they would use this methodology to develop these technology informed solutions. And it was great. And to Amy's point on how to bring talent, and we thought this is an example of not everyone wants to join the military, join the government. But if you create opportunities for our best and brightest young men and women in universities like Stanford, to work in these tough problems, they take advantage of it. There's a thirst and a demand to work on these tough challenges. I have a military background and I know you do too, Jackie, and not that you have to have a military background to be patriotic, but it was encouraging to see people have an aspiration to serve and to contribute. Short of putting on a uniform, you know, these students, they came and they actually solved some of these challenges. And the good news and the bad news is they made some real progress in solving some of these problems. You know, four Stanford undergrads in 10 weeks can make huge progress. And that was really encouraging. And Jackie, the second part of your question,
Can you use that method to help us in cyber and to help specifically kind of all solve our cyber technological problems in the Department of Defense?
Yeah, and so let me just throw out a real fundamental challenge to solving cyber problems and a lot of technology problems for the government. And this goes, I think, to the theme of the whole session. The advances, you know, back in the Cold War that we prevailed in, you know, the advances in the technology we needed to win that, they're all developed in government labs and by big defense primes. But now the types of technology we need to prevail in today's conflict, you know, like cyber, AI, autonomy, and all those emerging, it's developed in the commercial technology base. And critically, you know, advances in those technologies are generated by consumer demand, not government directives. So you've got to create closer connectivity to the private sector. You know, so this relationship, this sharing has to happen, you know, or we cannot compete effectively. We are not going to get the cutting edge technologies like cyber. We need identified, adopted, and deployed at speed to the people that really need it to defend our interests at home and abroad. So, Hacking for Defense, again, just to wrap up, is an example. We've got this great potential, this great talent base. And if given opportunities, the good news is, you know, you build a field, people will come, our best and brightest across the country. This course is now taught at over 50 universities in several countries abroad. So we're hoping this is a good indicator that our talent, our top talent, wants to serve, wants to contribute, wants to work on these tough challenges. Cyber is a great example of the type of technology where we absolutely need to harness our young, our best and brightest. You know, before they go off, they may still want to go off to Google and Facebook and do startups, but maybe give them a chance short of serving in the government to contribute. And that's what we hope this Hacking for Finance program is an example of that. And Jack, I know we've been in touch about maybe joining our class this quarter. So I'll shamelessly use this opportunity to say, well, we welcome your participation and thanks for your volunteering.
Yes, that is something that I need to, I have missed most of the events so far.
Plenty left to do. And we look forward to you're going to be wonderful with our students. And thank you.
So I want to, one of the things that Joe brings up is this, the way technology is developed today is very different than the way technology was developed in, you know, 1950 and 1960, when this thing called the Defense Industrial Base was built. And in some ways, our acquisition still moves at the speed of the 1950s and 1960s contracts, maybe sometimes actually slower. So I was interested in hearing the panel's thoughts about whether the acquisition kind of authorities, the contracting mechanisms, the way the Department of Defense is designed to interact with the private sector, is that set up for the Department of Defense to utilize some of the kind of, especially the defensive cybersecurity technology that is out on the market today? Are we able to tap into the commercial enterprise here at all? Or are we stuck with our $8 billion contracts for artificial intelligence that we give to Booz Allen?
Jackie, I could take a quick stab at that if I haven't used my airtime up. I'd say the short answer is no. I say we have a system that was very effective at prevailing in, you know, I say like Cold War conflicts. You know, if you want to build an incrementally better aircraft carrier, submarine, fighter jet, we can do that with our current system. We develop requirements and adopt new technology. And we can't throw that out because we still need to develop incrementally better large end systems like aircraft carriers. But now the types of technology we need to develop and deploy at speed, we can't wait that long. We got to do it faster. Again, it's last week's software update, you know, and Amy, I think was it Eric Schmidt or Mike Brown on your great panel last week or a few days ago talked about Tesla's just updating your driveway, with the new software updates. Well, we kind of need military systems to have the same kind of speed and agility. So the short answer, Jackie, to your question is no. It doesn't mean we have to throw out our old system, but I think we need a complementary system. And great strides have been made. Our own Defense Innovation Unit down in Mountain View here down the street that Ash Carter stood up. Mike Brown directing now. Raj Shaw, former director, works with Amy on a great project at Hoover. So we need both. We need to keep building those cutting edge large end systems, but we need last week's software. We need a cyber response, and that needs to happen in much greater speed, and it's going to come out of the private sector. And again, this is what the topic of today is all about. How do we identify those technologies emerging, you know, being developed in the private sector, adopt them and deploy them at speed? So I think we need two systems, or at least an additional system to the one that helped us win the Cold War to help us meet, you know, today's emerging threats.
Jackie, I would just jump in. I rarely disagree with Joe, but I'm going to try to be heretical here and say I'm way more pessimistic than he is. I think the old system that he says that is, you know, good for some things like large systems, I don't think that's working well either. I mean, the F-35 is, you know, the poster child for this, right? How many decades? I mean, I've had a kid grow up and go to college in the time it took to develop the F-35. And it's over budget, underperforming. So I don't think our old system, our acquisition system, is working well at all. And I think the fact that, and we talked about this at the Defense Innovation Unit earlier this week, the fact that we have to create special innovation units is the best indicator that the normal system is broken, right? If we have to have units that say innovation in them and we laud how great they are, it means our regular system is dysfunctional. So, and software is only exacerbating these challenges, right? Because software, as Joe points out really well, has to be updated so frequently. But let's not kid ourselves. Our hardware systems need to be developed at a much faster pace as well, at much lower cost. And DoD is not at all set up with its acquisition system to do that at scale at this point. So there is an urgent need for radical acquisition reform.
And I'll just say, I've been out of government over a year now, but I admittedly, tend to sugarcoat some of the challenge of the government when you're in the government, but I probably need to be a little more cold and straightforward. But I do agree with you, despite hoping that our old system may have some utility for some of those big systems, but certainly appreciate their big challenges there. Yeah, I remember the F-35 when my kids were in grade school as well, and they're now one's serving in the Army. So
I feel like Peter has to live this with the Navy, because every few years the Navy comes to him and says, or comes to the Naval War College and says, we think we want to fight warfare a different way. We think we want to buy different weapon systems. And every few years, Peter goes to great lengths to tell them, oh, you need to invest in networks. You need to invest in software. Talks about how they need to cut red tape. And they end up handing you back a gold-plated aircraft carrier. So what's been your experience, Peter?
I think Amy said something right at the end of her last intervention that I think is just right. Let's just stipulate. The defense acquisition system is broken in many ways and needs radical reform. I don't even think the people, you know, as Joe said, you know, when we're inside the government, we defend things, why it is. But I think, you know, the smartest people in Congress and the smartest people in the government are very unhappy with how acquisition takes place. But I did want to say that the private sector bears its share of the blame, particularly on the cyber and software and telecommunications side of things. So for all the innovation that's been produced in the private sector, they've also produced lots of vulnerabilities that they then sell to the government, and that then causes warfighters and government executives a lot of angst, right? Now, just very quickly to get at Jackie's last points. We have to remember about the acquisition system that it's within a democratic system. It's the way it is, not because anybody thinks it's the right way to do things. It's because congressmen want oversight. They want to steer contracts to different states. Everybody wants a share. We know that major programs exist in 50 states and the territories. We understand that some of the oversight is erratic and points in different directions during different Congresses. So that it's a feature, not a bug, within the democratic system of funding military innovation in the defense industrial base. To Jackie's last point, the services, and by the way, the IC, that actually buy things bear a lot of the burden for failure as well. Eugene Goltz and I wrote a book, more than a decade ago, I'm getting old, talking about how the one thing that you really needed to do if you're going to use the innovative parts of the defense industrial base and the private sector more generally was you need a clear vision from the military about what they need. The specifications for systems and weapons and all that would be much more effectively met by the private sector if the military itself could make decisions, stick to them, and monitor for whether what they've asked for is being delivered. But unfortunately, as Jackie says, you know, the Navy decides every 3 years they're going to rethink how they fight. And there's good reasons for that. We have a rise of a near-peer competitor and a great power. It's a very complicated problem. Some of the baseline stuff, like the need for better C4ISR, C5ISR, the need to break down stovepipes between systems that share information, that stuff has been well known for more than 20 years, and we're still making the same kinds of mistakes when the services try to think through what they need to purchase and then put the request for information and the contracts out into the private sector. Okay, off my high horse, next.
Well, that's all gonna change with CJADC2, because we all know that for a program to succeed, it needs to have as many letters in the acronym as possible. And so I think that CJADC2, which for all those of you who are not like huge wonky followers of defense contracts, CJADC2 is the combined joint, I actually don't know what it all stands for, but it's actually supposed to be the networks that make all the sensors and the weapons and the communications talk to each other. And it's kind of a running joke that this will eventually fail, as most of these attempts to buy networks generally end up failing. I want to go back to something that Peter brought up that kind of pivots right back to Erica and Amy, which is, so I used to be a reservist at Cyber Command. And one of the things that we were doing is we're trying to do kind of technical and academic outreach. The problem was I didn't live or work in Fort Meade, nor do I, thank God, have a classified computer in my home. So in order for me to tell people in technical companies or in academia what the command was interested in learning about or potentially in the future investing in, I needed to know what they cared about. It took a year and a half for them to declassify their problem statements about what they cared about on the technical side. So I'm interested kind of on Erica and Amy's side, because Erica, you've lived this from working at both a financial institute and Cyber Command. Tell me about, can you explain to the audience, what's a Terraline? What is open source intelligence? And then how does like the classification of information in cybersecurity make it more difficult to share information than it might be in like some other domains?
Sure. I mean, like the basic summary is that most of the space that you're operating in is classified, and a lot of it, you know, a lot of it seems to be classified for like no particular reason, right? And so like typically when we think about classification, we think about, the importance of protecting sources and methods, right? Because you wouldn't want those types of things to be out in the open, because they could give adversaries an opportunity to exploit them and cause detrimental national security consequences. And so I guess, you know, coming at this from more of a strategy perspective and less of a technical perspective, and thinking about how the government and how the DoD in particular reaches out to the academic community, I think that the challenge is that you become so used to operating in a classified environment that you don't, you're not socialized into having the conversations that you can have in an unclassified environment, because it's so much easier to just have the full scope of a conversation in a completely classified environment, even when 75% of what you're talking about is unclassified, right? And so I think that the negative path dependent outcome that leads to is that, you know, the DoD does engage with academics, but it's only some academics. It's this very weird subset of academics who are in some way part of the PME system or work in places like MITRE and other types of FFRDCs. And so who are able to sort of have that kind of unconstrained conversation and not have to worry too much about distinguishing between what's classified and what's not. And so the problem is that you have this like very sort of self-selecting group of people. And I think that limits the full sort of perspective and the rigor and the debate and the diversity of views out there that could shed light on some of those important questions. But that will require, a sort of cultural willingness to have the conversations that, even for forgetting about like overclassification of information, just have the conversations that you can have in an unclassified environment, because there are lots of really important questions that need to be asked and answered that can happen entirely in that space. And I think it's more of just a default of, it's just easier to, you know, to talk in a classified environment, because then you don't have to worry about, making those distinctions. And the problem is that means you're only having a conversation with a very small subset of academics. And they have their own bias and their own perspective, and may not be the right people to get at some of those hard questions. Sorry, yeah. I'm on my soapbox with that. I'm like, really, this is like something that really animates me. I'll stop talking.
Yeah, Jackie, maybe just a quick two finger, if to use our CSAC vernacular, but Erica just makes a great point about the cultural challenges, you know, and that, you know, and Amy, I know you've seen this a lot. There's sometimes there's a stigma in academia to work with classified information, or certainly to work with the government. And Erica's point, we're narrowing the field of academics that we bring to the table. Not nothing against those that do self-select and work with the government and these organizations, but boy, there's so much more out there. You know, Amy, you work closely, but think of all your colleagues who, you know, for lack of pathways or maybe for lack of understanding how to support them or for disincentives to work for them. You know, because certainly you work with classified information, you're not going to publish anything, and that's the currency of academia. And you're not going to be cited anywhere. And maybe those who want to serve or work hard, like you, Jackie, and everyone here on this panel, will work hard and put out work that's only going to be seen by people with clearances. But that culture needs to change, as you identified, Erica, and we need to create more opportunities to bring academics to the table. And classification is just, and we're just overclassified. There's a sense that if it's not classified, it's not important, and that's just not true. I mean, we've all been, I think everyone here has looked at classified cables, and you compare them with the best thing coming out of the academia, and there's not a huge difference. You know, sometimes academia reads a lot nicer, but the classified stuff, it has a few sources and methods and names, but it's really doesn't have the benefit of our best brains, and we need to fix that.
So I would just add, I think the classification problem is particularly acute now. So why is it more consequential now than it's been in the past? I think there are two reasons for that. The first is particularly in cybersecurity. As Mike Hayden likes to say, offensive cyber operations have an intelligence bloodline, right? They came out of the intelligence community. And so there is a natural penchant to really classify as much as you possibly can. So that even the phrase, as you know, Jackie, offensive cyber operations, the phrase itself was classified until the mid 2000s. It's insane, right? So to Erica's point and to Joe's point, if we want to have strategic discussions about what should our cybersecurity strategy be, what do we need to do as a nation to improve our posture, we need to have unclassified ways to have those discussions. In the same way that we had in an unclassified space, pivotal discussions involving academics that led to deterrence theory during the Cold War. So we can't make conceptual progress without involving a broader array of actors. That would be I'm obviously self-interested because I'm an academic. I think academics are important. But that's the first reason I think it's particularly important that we deal with the classification problem. The second reason is we live in a new technological era. You asked about open source intelligence. Governments are no longer dominating the collection and analysis of information. And so we can wish for an earlier time where exquisite assets and governments controlled that universe, but those days are gone. So anyone with an internet connection, anyone with a cell phone can access incredible satellite imagery with great resolutions, approximating or actually exceeding what the US government had in years past. We have a new world of, you know, monitoring events on Twitter. And so this is a completely new world. As I'm arguing, and this is a chance for me to shamelessly plug my new book that's coming out, talking about technological challenges to the intelligence community. But this is a new world where we have to deal more with open source information. And especially when we talk about cybersecurity, the intelligence community needs to produce for a broader array of customers that don't have security clearances and don't work in three-letter agencies and don't work in secured facilities. So you're a tech leader, or you're a venture capitalist, or you're a researcher at a university doing cutting edge semiconductor design. You need to have relationships with the intelligence community to protect intellectual property and to keep this nation safe. And so that requires pretty radical transformation of the intelligence community to think about producing for the open. Right, Sue Gordon has talked about this a lot. Voters need intelligence, right, produced for them to understand about foreign threats to elections, for example. So we're seeing a move in that direction, but not fast enough.
So, Jackie, can I just jump in?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I want to reaffirm the things that Amy said and Joe said, but I'm going to, again, be the negative person, not because I'm negative. I mean, one of the hardest things is cultural change. You know, we can change laws, we can change funding streams, those are hard, but changing the culture is exponentially more hard. And right now, we are caught in the vice of a couple of things that reinforce the older culture. One is the notion of great power competition. the thought that China is inside our networks, China is watching, China is has access to everything we have access in the government or parts of the government and more. And the security folks are sort of clamping down with that expectation. And the security folks tend to have the trump card of you are endangering national security if you, right? The second vice, and I really think Amy's right about, you know, sharing with the public and sharing with executives, but polarization is hurting us. Political polarization is hurting us. Because these two, I think to all of us, it seems very reasonable and it makes sense that the Eric Schmidts of the world should get the same kind of briefings so that they can understand how their corporation is being affected. But it becomes so politicized in Congress that there's a disincentive for the intelligence agencies to think that way. And if you do try to push in that direction, it becomes a cudgel to whack the heck out of people for, you know, giving away the family jewels or speaking the unspoken. So I totally agree, but my pessimism is rooted in cultural change and where we are in a political world, both internationally and domestically. But I share their.
I think there is a natural tension between desire to innovate with, especially the private sector, and then opening yourself up for vulnerability, especially to vulnerability to most of the private sector's companies these days. They're not clearly just American, right? They have interests overseas. A lot of them are actually multinational corporations. I mean, and the financial institutions, for example, these are global companies, right? So, and they have mixed interests. And so that's something I think that on the policy side and the legislature side, you really have to balance the risk in the investment and figuring out kind of how to come at the best end. Now, I think an example that really shows both the vulnerability of our systems and also the need to collaborate more with the private sector is the SolarWinds hack. And now the SolarWinds hack reveals something to us about supply chains and the vulnerability of our supply chains. Here's a company that we kind of thought was an American company, but you start digging in and you realize, well, these American companies are using components or intellectual property or other subcontractors that are not necessarily American. So I'm interested from the panel to hear, you know, about what SolarWinds taught us about supply chain vulnerabilities. And in general, how we should think about public-private partnerships when it comes to not only kind of investing in technology, but also guarding ourselves from vulnerabilities that come from more private sector collaboration.
I just want to jump in very quickly, Jackie, because you had a question in the Q&As that directly relates to this question in what in the chat function that directly relates to this. So somebody said in the chat, essentially, well, you know, but our supply chains are not classified. But here's the rub, and I can't name names here, but there have been academics on the outside who have studied supply chain vulnerabilities. And the only way they were able to get the data was through DOD. And then DOD essentially clamped down on their findings. So in other words, it was a really nice study, which actually taught that the vulnerabilities aren't as great as people believe. And then that itself was, the government essentially refused to share the data. So it's a really complex topic. And it's a shame because there's good academic, scholarly, best practice work to be done in that area.
I mean, I guess I could jump in here. I mean, Jackie and I have written, I don't know how many articles at this point about SolarWinds together. So I'm probably not saying anything that is new to her and that we haven't kind of talked through on so many occasions as we were sorting those out. But, you know, I guess from a supply chain perspective, and Jackie, you sort of hit on it. I think one thing that has frustrated me with the conversation around ICT supply chain security is that, first of all, that it's framed in terms of security, when the reality is that that's an impossible goal. We cannot secure the supply chain, period. It's too complex, it's too vast, it's too interdependent, it's not possible. Every node in the supply chain. And then the second is that I think that there's been this like political convergence where We talk about the supply chain in the context of great power competition with China. And that leads us to focus, to your point, Jackie, on, you know, well, the relative market share of, you know, Chinese companies versus, you know, American and, you know, European and, you know, East Asian companies that are our allies. And that's just, you know, it's just a ridiculous way of thinking about the challenge, because if you define it in that way, then it leads you to a solution of, well, we need to have, you know, that our supply chain is secure if it is comprised entirely of sort of trusted vendors. And I think SolarWinds shows us that that's just not the case. And so, you know, to me, that suggests we need to think more about resilience of the supply chain and less about its security, because it's simply impossible to identify all of the vulnerabilities, to remediate them before they're exploited. And therefore, we need to get better at sort of, you know, at sort of mapping dependencies and understanding like where the critical nodes are, so where there's a concentration of risk, and then doing better at sort of being able to adapt and respond when these things happen, rather than try to focus on just preventing them. Because to me, that's just the bar way too high, and we're setting ourselves up for failure.
Okay, I think you're exactly right. Focus on resiliency of supply chain. And just one other opportunity I think we should really stress, and we're trying to now, is, you know, look for international cooperation. It just, you know, it doesn't have to be resiliency from a U.S. perspective. You know, I think of rare earth metals as one example, how, you know, partnering with Australia and Japan and some others, we're trying to reduce those dependencies. So there's one of our, and this speaks to a broader point, but I use this as one data point. One of our big advantages with our competitor China is, you know, is our network of allies and partners, and reducing dependencies, making the supply chain more resilient. We've got a lot more resources to work with than China. So we need to really make sure we partner internationally and to reduce those dependencies and increase that resiliency. And I think that's a real unleveraged, some real unleveraged potential there that I think in the field of international cooperation that can really help in this regard.
I just add, I agree with everything that Joe and Erica said, Jackie, but I would add, you know, this is a chance for me to hit my bugaboo, which is deterrence, right? So I think Erica's point, we need to think more in terms of resilience, that we can't prevent these attacks, is exactly right. But you hear a lot of talk these days about we need to deter attacks like SolarWinds. Well, first of all, as you and Erica have written, it looks like SolarWinds was really an espionage operation. And that's typically thought of as being fair game, right? Everybody does it in physical space. Everyone tries to do it in cyberspace. So that's problematic if we are now putting this in the category of we need to try to deter it. Doesn't look like deterrence works in most areas of cyberspace. So it's really important to shift the conversation from the D words, defense and deterrence, to resilience and intelligence. That's the game we should be playing in cyberspace, and that should be the focus of public-private partnerships.
We want to take this opportunity to jump on another question, a really wonderful question that was in the chat. So there was a question about intellectual property theft and public-private partnership. Now, Peter and I have worked on this in a few war games, so we had the honor, privilege, and the horrible pain in the butt of having to run two war games that dealt with critical infrastructure and cyber attacks. And I think one of the most interesting phenomenon that we took from both those games is first kind of like, what does the private sector want? And in general, the private sector wanted from the Department of Defense to be more proactive and assertive about decreasing the adversary's ability to conduct these IP attacks. But the other thing that we found was the second game we played was called the Defend Forward game. And we were trying to understand like, well, what is Defend Forward operationalized? How does that look like? What is the commercial sector? How does the commercial sector feel about that? And so the question is about what does Defend Forward when it comes to intellectual property theft? How does Defend Forward, which for those of you who are not as kind of wonked out about this strategy, Defend Forward is broadly this idea that the US Department of Defense is going to go beyond its networks to try and negate adversary abilities to conduct cyber attacks even before they conduct them. But it's a bit kind of fuzzy about what that really means. So what does Defend Forward have a role here with IP theft? And if so, what is that?
I want to say two things. One is just a reflection on the things that were said just before this, and then I'll answer your question as best I can directly. So the one thing about, you know, SolarWinds as espionage or defend forward activities being what, you know, what are they, is that it's really hard to discriminate and to understand what is espionage versus what is something for a more nefarious purpose, actually offensive cyber operations. And I think it's really hard to tell, and it's often not clear, particularly early. You know, I'm not a technical person, but my understanding of the technology is that, you know, rooting out what's actually been done to you and what it means is very difficult. So that means when the Americans say, oh, we're just, you know, gathering intel, or somebody says we're just gathering intel, and that's okay, that's part of the rules of the game. It's a trust but verify situation, because it very well could be there's a leave behind that has a different purpose and a different mechanism. To the second thing is, and this is sort of contrary to DoD thinking, I suspect, but the intellectual property rights question is very important. But a lot of that is State Department, DOJ, Commerce, and the diplomatic efforts of the United States to set an international framework in place. And I think the United States hasn't, I mean, and I know there's a lot of good people working on this, but I think on the IP side, a much stronger effort could be made to enforce property rights, or at least get agreement on the parameters for the intersections, whether it's China or Germany or any other country, about what constitutes a good international regime regarding property rights in the generically cyber domain.
Well, we had to, Erica, unfortunately, had what every parent knows about during this pandemic world, which is she had some parenting obligations that she had to jump on, had to deal with at this time. So we had to miss her for the very end. But I want to ask one more question before we get to the lightning round. And that is, we've talked a lot about this thing called the defense industrial base. Does that include, in today's defense industrial base, does that include companies like Google, FireEye, CrowdStrike, and SolarWinds? Actually was attributed by private companies far before, in fact, we still haven't seen a public attribution come from the Biden administration. So what is the defense industrial base in today's cybersecurity world?
So I'll jump in on that a little bit, Jackie. So I actually did a little digging yesterday in preparation for today about what the DIB cybersecurity program includes, who's actually in it. And in fact, Google's not in it. And to the earlier point about universities, there are only four universities that are in it, or parts of universities that are in it, because they operate, again, on classified networks and have classified facilities. So if you look at the top 10 universities in computer science or electrical engineering who are producing the cutting edge research, including with cybersecurity in mind, none of them are in this for information sharing, right? And very few small companies or startups or companies like Google are in the DoD's Defense Industrial Base Cybersecurity Program. So I would argue that we need to have a much more expansive understanding of what the Defense Industrial Base is, because so many of these technologies are born dual use today, right? To Joe's earlier point about, you know, it used to be innovation for defense came in the government and then went commercial. Now it's the other way around. Technologies are born in the commercial area or in universities and migrate to the commercial sector, and they're inherently dual use. So we have to think about defense innovation base as being dual use at birth.
I think that's a very astute observation. And I hope to see like recommendations like those kind of be implemented more practically, because I think that our understanding of a very rigid defense industrial base is not super helpful, both for cybersecurity and then also the actual partnerships and development We didn't have time to get to it today, but part of why the defense industrial base are the companies that they are is because there are so many onerous requirements put on companies in order to contract with specifically Department of Defense. So not only like the normal government regulations and difficulty of contracting, but on top of it, there are security requirements. And actually in the attempt to try and be more secure, most recently, there's been new legislation that increases the amount of cybersecurity requirements for companies that are contracting with the Department of Defense. And the knockdown effect of that ended up being there were even less companies, and especially very few kind of startup and companies that are not traditionally in the defense industrial base that are able to fulfill the contracts with the Department of Defense. And, you know, we make legislation, sometimes we don't understand the externalities of our good intentions. So that with that, we are kind of right in time for the lightning round. This is when I ask very nuanced questions that require a lot of explanation and then give no time for that. So we all go off mute. and we will, let's start with an easy one. There's a lot of debate right now about whether the Cyber Command commander, General Nakasone, should still be in charge of what we call dual hat, who is in charge of both Cyber Command and the National Security Agency. So what do you think? Dual hat or not?
Look, this is a big debate, as my panelists know even better than I do, that's been raging for a long time. I think at this point, the only thing worse than keeping the dual hat is getting rid of the dual hat. Right? So this is like, would you rather be shot or stabbed? There are problems with the dual hat. There are problems with separating the dual hat. At this point, my argument for keeping the dual hat, so the head of Cyber Command is also the director of the National Security Agency, is really a few reasons. Number one, the talent issue, right? There still is a need. There's a shortage of critical talent, in particularly technical talent, that is required for both the NSA mission and the Cyber Command mission. And as long as we have such extreme talent shortages, we really get benefits by having those agencies work closely together. The second reason is coordination. Right? Coordination is so important. And once you remove those two, you're going to now exacerbate coordination challenges. We already have 18 agencies in the intelligence community, hard to coordinate across them, hard to coordinate across DoD. So there are real benefits to that coordination piece. And then the third is, it's a busy time. Missions expanding. We just talked about SolarWinds. We haven't even talked about Microsoft Exchange and what the Chinese are up to. So really difficult time now to be thinking about the disruption of organizational change of these two really pivotal agencies when there is so much for them to do. But I recognize there are huge problems with the dual hat.
That was actually an extremely nuanced and really like lovely argument that is just far too good for this round. Joe Beer, you get 1 second. Yes or no?
You know, not to punt and say I agree with Amy, but I do agree with Amy, but I would just say, added to her argument, all the advantages you mentioned, but the service component cyber capabilities are increasing. So that's kind of picking up some of the slack. So that I think that the importance of having coordination, unit of effort, and not diluting the talent pool are critical. And maybe I would lean towards keeping it the way it is, but really strengthen the levels below that, like across the services, so where they can do some of the heavy lifting and not put it all on a one person's plate, which is pretty onerous.
I'm going to punt and refer you to my colleague Chris Demchak's piece in W, in the War on the Rocks, which rehearses some of the arguments. And that's a nice way to punt and also give a shout out to my good friend, Chris.
That is a good piece. Okay. We must be quicker. Is there a rift between Silicon Valley and the DoD, or has that been overhyped?
Yes.
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 Yes, there's a rift, and it's been overhyped.
Yes, there's a rift. It's not been overhyped. There is some encouraging work to close the rift, but there's a huge gap left.
Okay. Hey, we've talked a little bit about supply chain vulnerabilities. That brings up another question about export control legislation. Export control for cybersecurity vulnerabilities. Yes or no?
You can't export control your way out of cybersecurity problems.
You don't. I'm just going to say you don't want to kill the golden goose, and I'm afraid that some of these solutions might be worse than the problems that they're solving.
Agree.
All right. We've talked a lot about different technology. We've talked a lot about cyber today, but technology has had a huge influence on modern warfare, especially the American, what we consider the American way of war. So who has had a bigger role in the American modern way of warfare? Raytheon or Microsoft?
Raytheon.
Raytheon, but Microsoft's going to catch up.
Raytheon, but Microsoft should play a bigger role.
I'm going to say Microsoft, you don't drop a bomb without putting it in an Excel spreadsheet. There, I would bet you that there is not an ordinance that has been dropped in the last 10 years that has not somehow been used a Microsoft system. My personal belief.
PowerPoint.
PowerPoint. Okay.
But structurally, Microsoft until relatively recently was largely a vendor. And a vendor that just provided kinds of software that were used just as you described, that's a difference. Now, I think Joe's right. Long-term, might change.
We didn't get to talk about this, but there's been a lot of debate about whether private companies should be allowed to hack back. What do you think? Hack back or not?
Yes, bring more resources to the table. I think there should be some type of regulation, but I think it's a resource we should explore ways to appropriately get them into the fight.
No.
There's a little more experience here, but I'm all for Jim Mattis says that you're in a fight, bring all your friends with guns. Maybe we should find some more friends to bring, but I know there's some problems here.
I'm worried who else they would shoot and what the blast radius would be, Joe.
That did happen in one of our war games that Peter and I ran together, and it did not go well. That was the most contentious part of the plenary at the end.
Can I just say one thing, Jackie? No, and I sat in the Pentagon when, this is honest to God, true stuff, when Ross Perot was talking about launching an operation into a country in the Middle East to rescue some Americans. People took that seriously. I was absolutely scared, silly at the notion because of the knock-on effects.
Well, we unfortunately are now out of time. So I want to thank my panelists. This has been an extraordinary conversation. We ended up adding one more session to the series. And that's because we have the amazing opportunity to talk about what we have not really talked about a lot yet, which is cyber strategy, escalation, deterrence, coercion, all those fun words, and signaling. And we have the honor of having David Sanger and Dmitry Alperovich with us on this last one on the 26th. So join us. That is a different time. It'll be at 11 o'clock Pacific. Join us then. Thank you all.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thanks, Jackie.